It has been almost 5 months since Yusuf has been imprisoned, awaiting his deportation hearing. It is now just 2 days away. Samir Megahed, Yusuf's father, tries to remain hopeful. Yusuf's trial is held in the Chrome Jail in the swamps outside Miami. ICE has flown in a team of 4 lawyers to try the case. Yusuf's lawyer, Charles Cook, has agreed to take the case for free. No cameras are allowed inside.
We are currently in the second day of the trial. We just finished the testimony of the government's first witness, both his cross-examination and his direct examination. What's at stake is what young Muslim men in America can do and act like in America today. The reality here is, if you're a Muslim in America, you can't think like everybody else. You can't think like your colleagues. I have another client that we went to lunch with a few weeks ago who's about the same age as Yusuf. And I was telling him about Yusuf's case, and it was very interesting what he said. He had very little sympathy for Yusuf. He said, what is he thinking in America as a Muslim man? You can't go surfing on the internet and look at sites. You can't hang around with other people that are Muslims and talk about Islam. And I frankly find that sad.
David Cole is a law professor at Georgetown University Law Center and an expert in constitutional and First Amendment rights. He says that the targeting of immigrants in America is nothing new.
Historically, whenever the United States has faced a security threat, it has responded by targeting immigrants with its most restrictive measures. And I think that's partly because it's easy to do so. You know, it's one thing to say to American people, we face a greater security threat. You've got to sacrifice some of your liberties and rights in order to protect the country. But it's another thing to say to American people, we face a greater security threat, but we're going to give you more security by sacrificing somebody else's rights, namely foreign nationals, immigrants, people who have no voice in the political process. We did it in 1919 after a series of terrorist bombs. We went out and rounded up thousands of foreign nationals on pretextual charges, charges of guilt by association. Not one of them was ever found to have been involved in any of the bombings. During World War II, we rounded up thousands and thousands of Japanese immigrants. This kind of anti-immigrant targeting has been a constant feature in the United States at every point that we've had a security crisis. When you want to take action before somebody has actually done anything wrong, well, the criminal law doesn't really allow you to do that generally. Criminal law requires you to have some proof that an individual has either committed a terrorist act or has conspired to commit a terrorist act or has attempted to commit a terrorist act. It requires that you put the evidence on the table, that you give a person a fair trial. But if you use immigration law, you can find all sorts of pretextual charges to use against people. The government employs secret evidence often in immigration procedures. The same sort of fair trial rights don't necessarily apply. The Supreme Court has said that it's permissible to selectively single out people for immigration enforcement based on their affiliation with political groups. So the same sets of protections and rights don't exist, makes it easier to use the immigration process.
Dan Vara was the highest-ranking ICE attorney in the state of Florida from 2003 to 2006. He says that after the September 11th attacks, he began working closely with the FBI. His prosecutions became a model for using immigration courts as an arm of counterterrorism across the country.
2-3 days after 9/11, people like myself got the word from Washington that some of those obstacles that we had to doing some of the cases that we had been preparing for years were no longer there. And we were allowed to move forward and identify people for charges to be taken into detention and to be prosecuted, again, not criminally, but for the purpose of removing them from the United States. In Florida, once we began our work with the Joint Terrorism Task Force and even its precursor, just the FBI and other loosely associated groups, our involvement was day-to-day. We shared, at the height of my prosecution experience, FBI would feed me information every day.
Vara is proud of his work with the FBI and defends the tactic of seeking the deportation of residents against whom no criminal charges can be proven.
Many people get prosecuted and get acquitted, and they're guilty. When you sit at the table with other prosecutors from other branches of the U.S. government, and agents from all these agencies, and you're reviewing evidence. I mean, the goal is to find the way to deal with the threat. And if the only thing you have is tax fraud, if the only thing you have is an immigration violation, then, frankly, that's what you use. An immigration charge is administrative in nature. The burden of proof is less than they are in a criminal trial. So even though you got acquitted in a criminal trial, the reality is that the government could still meet its burden at clear and convincing evidence. There are so many people that put their fingers in every single terrorism case that I would tell you unequivocally that mistakes are not made.
In terms of identifying actual terrorists, the government has been very ineffective. So, for example, in the first 2 years after 9/11, the government locked up, mostly using immigration powers, over 5,000 foreign nationals, almost all Arab and Muslim, in anti-terrorism preventive detention measures. Of those 5,000, not one stands convicted today of any kind of terrorist offense. So the government's record there is 0 for 5,000.
They don't have the evidence in these cases, and that's what they see as the beauty of immigration court, is heck, you don't need evidence. You just need a judge who's willing to look at all the garbage evidence and make a conclusory statement that I think you've met the burden of proof. Thank you very much. Have a nice life. Arguably, anything is the proper use of the immigration laws. Congress has designed it to be in many ways like the tax laws that cut Al Capone. Well, if we can't get them on the criminal charges where we have to meet this incredibly high burden of proof, we'll just deport somebody on an incredibly vague immigration statute. These immigration courts are part of the Department of Justice. They are in the executive. This is not a judicial branch. This is not an independent judiciary. This judge was appointed by a previous attorney general. He works for the attorney general. These FBI agents work for, oddly enough, the same attorney general. The folks that are prosecuting this case at Homeland Security are also in the executive branch. The reality is you have the executive branch being both the prosecutor, judge, and jury in this case. We should all be concerned about that. We should be concerned that there is a complete lack of judicial independence here. Why would an immigration judge, whose boss is the one, presumably, that wants to prosecute and deport this man, say, "I'm sorry, boss, you're wrong"? Boy, it would take a judge with a great deal of courage to do that.
Many people focus on the Bush administration and particularly on 9/11 and the reaction to 9/11 and on, for example, the Patriot Act. But what you miss when you focus in that way is that this is a broader problem.
Now we're in the middle of the Obama administration. Attorney General Holder has approved this. Trust me, if he hadn't approved it, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So clearly the Obama administration is continuing the same enforcement mentality that first Clinton and then the Bush administration followed in immigration.
There's involvement at the highest levels. The Secretary of Homeland Security, I would be very surprised if that person was not Janet Napolitano was not involved in this case. I would be very surprised that if that was the case. Not only because it's a terrorist case, but because of the publicity that it's getting.
A local Islamic group is speaking out about immigration officials' decision to detain Yusuf Megahed.
Having a fair trial and the jury finding not guilty, it seems like a slap in
their
face.
Their backup plan was to punish them in immigration.
Yusuf was arrested for one reason and one reason only, and that's because he looked Muslim.
With Yusuf's trial already underway, protests by community, religious, and civil rights groups continue to grow. In an unusual move, four of the jurors from his criminal trial, including foreman Gary Meringer, begin speaking out on Yusuf's behalf.
This just doesn't seem right.
There are things under the law that were put into effect after 9/11 that allows the government to simply say, "We think you're a terrorist, and therefore you will be detained until you have your day in court," and there's no judicial review of that determination. It's just a unilateral determination made by immigration officials.
We didn't know whether Yusuf should be deported or given full citizenship and allowed to finish engineering school. What we did know a lot about was the case we saw in federal court, and based on that case, he was not guilty of anything, whether it's beyond a reasonable doubt or by a preponderance of the evidence, as might be required in immigration court, or by any measure, that we saw, this kid has, there was no evidence that he had done anything wrong. It's like telling the government, if that's all you got, let him go.
I've been doing criminal defense work for 15 years, and I've never heard of jurors going to the media and saying how outraged they are about what the government is doing to somebody who they just stood in judgment of. It's amazing that they would do that. But I think it says something even more about the disconnect between our government policies and what the people who live in this country want.
If I do talk to somebody about this case, what positive can come about it for me? Not forget about Youssef for a minute. Is there anything good that can happen? And the answer is no. But this is what I need to be doing. I would really like to think at the end of the day I did everything possible I could to get him a fair shake.
I was a history major. And during the pre-American Revolution, what jurors were doing and the verdicts that they were turning down and offenses that were being prosecuted by then the British government was the same sort of thing. It was, we're not going to enforce these laws are wrong, what you're doing is wrong. And that's what these jurors are saying, what you're doing is wrong. The law may allow you to do this, but it's wrong.
What do you think is going to happen at this trial?
Well, based on the evidence that I know of, it ought to be a very short finding of not guilty, but based on what I've heard about the immigration courts, the immigration judges, the influence of the government, the fact they can put on evidence and not even have to show it to the defense, what I think is going to happen is he's going to be found guilty as some sort of terrorist, aider and abettor, whatever, and sent back. Yeah, it's funny, sent back, but sent to Egypt, where he hasn't lived since he was, I think, 11 years old.
At first, I was shocked because I knew the family very well, and I knew the Mujahid family. I knew their son. I knew how good he was, and I have a son. So I was scared. I told him, you know what, I don't feel comfortable for you. What if they did the same thing to you? So it made me feel unsafe. It made me feel scared for my kids. But I felt like I can't let the fear take over me. And I start thinking, right, you know, we have rights. We're American citizens. That we should fight this. It shouldn't take this route because this is wrong. And if we don't fight now, everybody else are scared, afraid, and they're going to hide away from it. So we thought we could fight it together. And I felt, you know, we can do it. If we as a community work together, we can do it. Give me a kind of, you know, strength to stand up and fight. And the more you learn about your rights, you have to stand up for your rights. We had a privilege to fight for our rights and speak our minds and have the freedom to practice our religion. Not because I'm wearing a headscarf that means I'm suspect. Not because I'm a Muslim, I'm a suspect. And maybe, you know, with all of us united, you know, are united as a community, Muslims, non-Muslims, everybody else, work together to solve this problem. No profiling whatsoever. We will be all safe, because that will be justice.
Yusuf got his family, his mother and his father and his oldest brother naturalized, but they're having mixed feelings because their son is still being held by immigration authorities. Please make dua for the family. Keep tab on the case and support in any way you can.
When anyone in our community or even in a minority community sees this case, especially because this family is immigrants, they see themselves and they see what could happen to them. And I think they're concerned now more than ever, especially everything that's been happening in our community with this case or nationwide. But the main point here is that we have to be aware as Americans, all Americans.
1 week into the trial, just as the defense is about to present its case, the judge makes an unexpected announcement.
The immigration judge terminated removal proceedings. He did the right thing. When the judge walked into the courtroom today, and the first thing he said was, we're going to go over the exhibits in the case. I knew at that point we had won. Because otherwise he never would have talked about the exhibits before I had presented a case. As soon as I realized that, I turned over to Youssef, and I said, I put my hand on his leg, and I said, you won. I don't think he understood me. He looked at me and he didn't understand. And Dustin, my co-counsel, leaned in and said, "You won the case." And then his big old grin, "You should smile now." And a big old grin came on his face. He now understands what a great victory this is, for justice in America. The government presented a case today, and the last 4 days, it was junk. It was all about junk. And as a result, the judge finally realized what it was and dismissed it. This is the second time in my 20-year career that a judge has dismissed charges against somebody and terminated proceedings based upon the government's lack of evidence. So this is a very unique happening for me, and really for any immigration lawyer.
Outside the Chrome Jail, supporters and press wait until sundown for Yusuf's release.
I'm very happy for this, and I'm looking forward to go back to university.
I'm feeling so happy for returning my son to spend the Ramadan with us. It is the first night of Ramadan. We feel so happy by having my son to our house again. And I want to send a message for the government that this family, family of Mujahid, came to this country to live in peace and to work and take their degrees. Let us finish this thing. Please let us, Mujahid, the family, live here in peace.
I think it's all over now. I'm happy.
Yusuf is one of the very few who beat their charges in both criminal and immigration court. Despite no charges ever being filed against him, Rabia Haddad was deported to Lebanon in 2003. After being found innocent of all charges, Sami Hammoudi was held by ICE and then finally deported to Palestine. He now teaches political science at Birzeit University. They both say that the America that they left is nothing like the country they were once proud to call home.
When people ask me about living in the U.S., this is before September 11th, as compared to Lebanon or other parts of the world, I would always make the comment that, everything else aside, it's still a country of law, where everybody is equal under the law.
I felt happy in the United States because I felt for the first time that I am free to think the way I want to think, to write the way I want to write, to go wherever I want to go. It's the opposite, 100%. I did not expect what happened after September 11th.
To this day, the government can walk into anybody's home, into any company, any firm in the U.S., freeze their accounts, confiscate all their documents on the basis of doubt. All they have to do is to say, we suspect you of terrorist activity.
In the United States, there is no justice. This is what I believe in, and this is what I teach my students. I don't believe that now inside the United States, anyone can say anything he wants. No. The American Muslims and Arabs are not exercising their full rights as other Americans. They cannot. Because they will be punished. And the government has many ways to punish people if they want to. And one time, Ashcroft said, if someone spit in the street, we can try him. We can make laws to try him and put him in jail, if we want.
Civil liberties, human rights, the Bill of Rights are all things of the past. This whole matter of democracy and liberty and the rule of law, and it's just a myth now. It's just a myth. Any Muslim or any Arab living in the U.S. and hearing me say this will not think twice about it. They know it, they feel it, they're living it. But I hope that other U.S. citizens don't end up on the wrong side of the fence to find out how bad this USA Patriot Act really is.
The mentality that will harass the Muslims and Arabs, the institutions that will harass Muslims, will harass others.
Measures first introduced against immigrants inevitably get extended and applied to U.S. citizens. So over time, it's all of our rights that are at stake. So the first measures that criminalized speech or that penalized political speech were targeted at immigrants, but ultimately became part of our criminal laws during World War I. The first measures that imposed essentially guilt by association were introduced in the immigration law in the early 1900s, but were extended to American citizens during the McCarthy era, and thousands of Americans were affected by that guilt by association. The first sort of ethnic-based targeting enforcement was against foreign nationals from countries whose ethnicity we didn't like. During World War II, that was extended, and we ended up locking up not just Japanese immigrants, but American citizens of Japanese descent. So whether it be, you know, racial discrimination or penalizing speech or guilt by association, the measures are introduced against immigrants initially, but eventually get extended to U.S. citizens.
But it created fear amongst the Muslim community, and a lot of people have become so concerned about stepping up to the plate and being an Americans. I mean, being American means that you have to stand up for your rights, that you speak your mind, you have freedom of worship, freedom of speech. Well, none of this has really flourished in our community after 9/11. Most people are scared to come up and speak their mind, simply because they've seen what happens to those who spoke.
Controlling the community is controlling their minds, controlling their feelings. They will all the time be watchful, not to say things they like to say. They will say things that the government would like to hear. Not to do anything that they show that they are full citizen who exercise their full rights.
I think a lot of people are just very scared. Like, they wouldn't really talk about things, or they would try to, like, distance themselves. So I think it's more of just trying to get by, trying to live their lives, you know, go to school, get a job, like, just live a normal life and not really so much involvement outside of that.
Back in Tampa, the Mujahid family sit down to celebrate the beginning of Ramadan, their first meal together since Yusuf's second arrest.
I didn't imagine that we are going to sit together with Yusuf in the first day of Ramadan. Welcome back, Yusuf.
I'm relieved. I'm happy that I'm out of this immigration jail. I was kind of expecting it that I be released, but not on a specific date, because the government did not have a case. Like, they were just holding me up for the heck of it. The government is profiling people, they're targeting people just based on their background, not of any crimes they have done. In my case, they, of my Muslim background, they were trying to say I'm a terrorist, or that I have to be deported on terrorism grounds. They just want you to sign the requesting deportation and leave instead of staying and fighting your case.
We asked Yusuf what he will do now that he has won. Who does he want to be held accountable for his years in prison? Will he continue to speak out on behalf of others who are facing similar charges? His father, Samir, interrupts before Yusuf can answer.
Don't ask him many questions, because the government still now can make an appeal against him.
Do you think they will appeal, or do you think?
I didn't know. They have the right to do anything.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc. You wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the VIRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. A new version of the 2025-2030 dietary guidelines published by the US government doesn't mention food's role in the climate crisis at all. Climate groups say this is an abdication of responsibility, with Americans feeling the effects of a warming planet more than ever. We'll prepare for you an article written by Marina Bolotnikova. The piece is titled, How U.S. Government Diet Guidelines Ignore the Climate Crisis. To keep the climate habitable, most scientists agree that switching to renewable energy alone isn't enough. Americans also need to change the way they eat. Environmental and public health advocates are pushing a new strategy to help get there, including climate breakdown in the official U.S. dietary guidelines, which shape what goes into billions of meals eaten across the country every year. Every 5 years, the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Human Services jointly publish a new version of the guidelines. They formed the basis for the public-facing eating guide, My Plate, formerly My Pyramid, as well as many government-backed meal programs such as National School Lunch. Historically, these guidelines have narrowly focused on human nutrition, but some are now saying they should be expanded to incorporate climate considerations as well. The current 150-page edition for 2020 through to 2025 doesn't mention food's role in the climate crisis at all. Climate groups say this is an abdication of responsibility, with Americans feeling the effects of a warming planet more than ever. The recently passed Inflation Reduction Act, the so-called most significant climate legislation in U.S. history, does very little to address the food system. Jesse Silverman, a senior policy associate for the Center for Science in the Public Interest, said, "Climate change poses a multitude of threats to human health and nutrition security. We cannot extricate these things from each other." Her group and 39 others, including the Union of Concerned Scientists and the American Academy of Pediatrics, in May, wrote a letter urging the U.S. government to include sustainability in the 2025-2030 dietary guidelines, which are now in development. A sustainability component would encourage Americans to eat less meat and dairy products, which have a significant higher climate impact than nutritionally comparable plant-based foods. Another signatory to the letter, Mark Rifkin, senior food and agriculture policy specialist for the Center for Biological Diversity, said, "It will be virtually impossible to even meet the 2 degrees Celsius limit in global temperature change without incorporating substantial reductions in beef intake." Walter Willett, a professor at Harvard University's School of Public Health, said the current guidelines advise Americans to eat far more animal products than is sustainable. The primary dietary chart recommends 26 ounces of protein from meat, poultry, and eggs a week, compared with just 5 ounces from plant-based foods, although there are alternative charts that show how vegetarians can get the same nutrients without meat. He said they also still basically say 3 servings of dairy products a day, which is actually really radical because our current consumption is 1.6 servings a day, adding, "To just recommend 3 servings of dairy products and say nothing about the environmental consequences if people really did that, it's just completely irresponsible. Because most Americans are deficient in fiber and fruits and vegetables, not animal products," Mark Rifkin, a dietitian, said, "climate-focused guidance would line up with what the public needs nutritionally." He said it would also help address other problems that stem from the meat-heavy U.S. food system, including risk of future pandemics, food security, and pollution from concentrated animal feeding operations, which disproportionately affect communities of color. A proposed list of questions released in April for the scientific panel that advises the guidelines didn't include sustainability. That worries advocates, but they say it's still early. Janet DeJesus, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services staff lead on the guidelines, said sustainability could still be included. DeJesus said, "We're not saying that it's not going to be in the dietary guidelines. We're not saying that at all." She added, "It's a high priority for the Health and Human Services leadership to address climate change." According to a United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization FAO report, countries including Germany, Brazil, Sweden and Qatar have addressed sustainability in their dietary guidelines. Canada's Food Guide advises choosing plant-based foods more often for the environment. Vox reported recently Germany has cut its per capita meat consumption by 12% since 2011. And its Minister of Food and Agriculture has recently prioritized a shift towards more plant-based eating. Advocates say a change in the U.S. dietary guidelines could have a similar influence. Jesse Silverman says, "The guidelines are much more impactful than I think a lot of people realize. Federal food aid programs have to comply with the guidelines, shaping how millions of people eat. For instance, the National School Lunch and National School Breakfast programs claim they served more than 7 billion meals a year to tens of millions of children before the COVID-19 pandemic. The guidelines also influence cafeteria foods served in government buildings, hospitals and other institutions, and are used in nutrition education programs. According to a recent paper in Communications, Earth and Environment, national school lunches reach makes it uniquely positioned to affect the dietary patterns of American children and adolescents and could aid in addressing the environmental impacts of food systems. Meat contributes disproportionately to school meals' impact on the climate, as well as land and water use. Because U.S. government programs and other large institutions claim they serve so many meals, sustainability advocates in recent years have focused on trying to influence their food buying decisions. California earlier this year allowed $100 million to help schools serve more plant-based meals. This isn't the first time the environment has been at issue in the nation's dietary guidelines. In 2015, a panel of nutrition experts that advised the 2015 through to 2020 guidelines addressed sustainability in its scientific report. The panel wrote, "In general, a dietary pattern that is higher in plant-based foods such as vegetables, fruits, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds, and lower in animal-based foods is more healthy, and it should be promoted, and is associated with lesser environmental impact." But after outcry from the meat industry and US Republican lawmakers, the recommendation to eat more plants was dropped from the final guidelines. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal at the time, the US Department of Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said sustainability was outside the purview of the dietary guidelines and compared the scientific committee to his granddaughter, whose colors outside of the lines. Bob Martin of the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future said about Tom Vilsack's comments, "It's really condescending stuff. The people involved in this were highly qualified." Agribusiness has a long history of influence over the dietary guidelines, and it will undoubtedly be a factor this time around as well. The meat and dairy industries spent $49.5 million on political contributions in 2020 and another $15.9 million lobbying the federal government. Food industry groups also routinely report lobbying on federal nutrition policy. According to federal lobbying records, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association between 2014 and 2016 spent more than $303,000 lobbying to keep beef in the dietary guidelines. Several industry groups, including the North American Meat Institute, the National Dairy Foods Association, and the National Turkey Federation, have already weighed in on the process for the 2025 through to 2030 guidance. The National Pork Producers Council wrote in a public comment in May, "While an important topic, sustainability is outside of the scope of the dietary guidelines." Jesse Silverman of the Center for Science and the Public Interest said, "Even though environmental advocates face an uphill battle, a lot has changed since the failed 2015 effort to incorporate sustainability." She added, "I think the public pressure to have concrete policies to address climate change has grown a lot in the years since then."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much, and to you too.
Dear listeners, Brother Miqdad is Islamic researcher and teacher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. It's a pleasure to be with you, as always. Okay, in our previous sessions, we discussed about the pros and cons of social media that we need to educate our teenagers. About cons, we saw a lot of cons. About pros, we saw some very interesting things that could be done. But there were so many cons, and how do we deal with all this? Like, we have pros in front of us, we have cons in front of us. Now, how do we teach our teenagers about, like, what can we do about that?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So, firstly, the pros and cons that we discussed in these previous sessions, it's important that we share them with our youths.
Yeah.
I remember once we had a group of youths in one of the classes, and we made a debate. And we said there's a plaintiff and there's a lawyer, and each of them have to, one group has to talk about the pros and one group has to talk about the cons. And so they themselves discuss this. It's important for them to realize, and they themselves realize about how the positives and negatives. So this is one, it comes back to awareness. And youth are very clever. Youth are very intelligent, and they know the positives and negatives. So this is something that we can do as parents, is help them understand. The second thing which is probably one of the fundamental things, is to timetable your social media usage.
Okay.
So this means that social media shouldn't be something that we have open throughout the day, mm-hmm. but rather just the way we have Salah 3 times a day, right? So you pray at particular times. I suggest that you have particular times for social media as well. So in the morning, for example, you put 15 minutes or half an hour, 1 hour for your social media, and then you open at that time, you close at that time.
Okay.
Management, yeah, exactly. So you shouldn't be doing anything at that time either, right? So if you don't open social media with a book, for example, no, close your book, close your studies, you don't do anything, you just want doing your social media, and spend good half an hour doing your social media, basically.
Okay.
But when the time finishes, when the half an hour is finished and the 45 minutes is finished, then stop, close it until the next time, which is maybe in the evening, for example, you can have another half an hour session.
There's going to become a lot of interesting stuff, but you have to close it.
Exactly, yeah. So you've kind of, you manage your time, basically.
Mm-hmm.
This will really, really help you to learn how to focus, it'll help you to manage your time, it'll help you to avoid distractions, avoid or the negative consequence, or the negative effects that come when you have social media open throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one very important thing, and this should be done for all other things as well. We kind of have a nice timetable in our day-to-day life where we schedule in our social media, we schedule in also our book reading, for example, we schedule our TV time, we schedule our time with family, and we don't mix and match. We don't kind of put 3 things in one basket. Always try to separate things and do things in their own time in an efficient way. So you have your Instagram time and you have your Facebook time. In an efficient way, spend all the time, all your energy and all your focus on that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have time with your family, spend time with the family without the phone.
Okay. So do not let social media distract you. Do not let social media waste your time, drain your time, drain your energy. So the first thing you said is time management, manage your time. If you're using social media, don't do other things at the same time. And if you're doing other things, don't do social media at the same time. Have a particular time about social media and manage it. If you have decided that I have to give half an hour, do not give more than half an hour to it. Well, what more can we do? I'll ask you all that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
Hey, stop! I got a
IRIP English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have 2 boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing. We're seeing how we can deal with the social media, knowing all the pros and cons. So the first thing you said, Brother McThought, was time management.
Another point is choosing your friends. So we talked about this in previous session as well. I mentioned the hadith once more time. So you have from the Messenger of Allah, Al-Maru ala dini khalilih. A person takes on the religion of the person who he counts as a friend, a person who is his friend. And therefore the Prophet says, فَلْيَنْظُرْ أَحَدُكُمْ مَنْ يُخَالْ. So make sure you choose your friend. Make sure you know who you are associating yourself with. On social media, make sure you choose the people that you are following, the people that you are interacting with, the people that are the source of the time that you're going to spend on social media. So be careful, be selective with the people.
Choosing friends.
Exactly. And the organization and institute and people that you are following, be very careful. Have people that are giving you some worth, giving you, benefiting you, not just...
Encouraging you,
not just chit-chat, not just random things, following people's lives for the sake of just following their lives. You know how some people, they put their whole life on social media.
Yeah.
And 1,000 other people are just following their life for no particular reason, but just that we want to know what this particular individual is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Avoid all of that. Make social media a very strong platform for you to do the right things, as a tool that enables you to do the right thing. And so choosing your friend is a very important tip to make sure that we are using social media in an efficient way.
Okay. So choosing your friend was the another one.
Another point about social media is to be wise in what we put out there. So whenever you interact with social media and you're not just a passive user, but also you are interacting, so either you're posting images or you're writing something, leaving comments behind, arguing or debating or expressing a thought, expressing your opinion, always choose your words carefully. Make sure that you are first and foremost, you are not lying, you are saying the truth. Secondly, you make sure that you say things that are beneficial. Don't just say anything. Always control how much you put. Don't be passive in your interaction with social media, but also don't just say whatever comes to your mind. Kan al-Masih yaqul, Prophet Isa would always say, la tukthiru al-kalam fi ghayri dhikrillah. Don't speak too much. When it comes to other than the remembrance of Allah, don't speak too much. Why? Because this hardens your heart.
Okay.
So as much as we can, you don't need to share everything. So obviously speak, obviously it doesn't mean only speech, but when you're sharing your opinion, your views, you leave comments, you share photos, don't just throw everything that comes in your mind.
Okay.
Be selective, be clever, be wise and mature about how much you put out there.
Exactly. So you're saying that sharing more content is also not recommended. As you mentioned, one of the hadiths is from Prophet Musa, who says that do not speak much if it's something other than Allah. Well, what is more in the store? We'll talk about that after a short break. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, no father has granted a gift to his child better than good manners.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. And I have with me Brother McThought, and we are talking what are the things that could be done to make better use of social media for teenagers. Yes, brother.
One of the things I would really encourage teenagers and youth out there is to use the social media at your advantage. And this means that use it to spread Islam. That's one thing. right? So as Muslims, we love our religion. We want our religion. We want others to also experience the beauty of this religion. We also want others to be reminded of the truth, to know the Ahlul Bayt and the beauty of the Ahlul Bayt, to be aware of how amazing these personalities were, what they taught us. To share this is very important with others. So if you are a good and a strong social media user, then use it for this. Use it to share valuable reminders. Use it to correct wrongdoings, really to spread the news, spread valuable Islamic content. It's be productive, be imaginative, be creative for the good. This is very important. Don't waste time into getting involved into pointless discussions or sharing your life, which is not worth anything for others. It's your precious life, your precious worth. The others don't need to know about it. Don't degrade yourself and humiliate yourself by sharing your emotions on a daily basis. It adds no value to yourself. It goes against your self-esteem. No, rather use it for this. Use it for being in contact with family and friends, as you mentioned before, Sadatul Raham. Use social media to be in touch with what's happening in the world, news, events.
Stay updated.
Stay updated, exactly. And use social media to spread Islam, to talk about, to remind people, to motivate people, to share goodness, remind people about climate change, remind people about
invite
helping others in charity.
Invite towards good.
Invite towards good. Remind people about the difficulties that will come if somebody is indulging in music or in haram acts, etc. Tell people about the Quran and the beauty of the Quran. Remind them.
Educate them more about Islam.
Exactly. And be creative. Come up with very beautiful and very inventive ways on how to do these things, because people like new things. People like to see creative design and arts and funny ways to do these things. Use the most important, the most beautiful ways of social media, but at your own advantage.
Yeah. And, you know, there are so many, I mean, I'm sure about this, that everyone is affected by a particular verse in a different way. So you can share your own experiences about the verse or explaining the verses of Holy Quran in the similar way, narrations and many more things. Thank you so much, brother, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, Islamic Upbringing. In case you have any questions, comments or suggestions for us, please feel free to contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. You can listen to this program again on our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanullah. God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.